Hi, everyone, and welcome to episode 38 of the Medieval Podcast. I'm Danielle Sobalski, also known as the 5-Minute Medievalist. As the days get shorter and the nights get longer, it's easy for our thoughts to turn to spooky things from days gone by. And what could be more medieval than witches? This was the time when everyone was pointing fingers and burning witches at the stake like crazy, right? Well, no. Witchcraft was a pretty complex topic in the Middle Ages, and it wasn't necessarily a death sentence, either. This week, I spoke with Gemma Holman, author of Royal Witches, from Joan of Navarre to Elizabeth Woodville. Her book investigates the scandalous accusations of witchcraft against four of England's leading ladies in the 15th century. We talked about the circumstances under which some of these women were accused, and even convicted, of witchcraft, as well as how and why calling a woman a witch was such a useful ploy, even for a king. Thanks, Gemma, for joining me today to talk about royal witches. I'm so happy to have you on the podcast.
Thank you. It's lovely to be here. Very excited.
So you're talking in this book about several royal witches. But before we get into that, let's talk a little bit about witchcraft in the Middle Ages, because it's not what people think it is. I think people generally have an impression of kind of the Salem witch trials, which are not medieval. So tell us a little bit about witchcraft in the Middle Ages.
Yeah, well, as you say, like, lots of people don't really know about magic in the medieval period. And I have to say that personally, before I sort of started researching the book, I didn't really know too much about it either. Because as you say, we hear so much about Salem witch trials and all the sort of early modern stuff. But, you know, the idea of magic and witchcraft had been around for centuries, if not sort of millennia before then. And it's really sort of in the period that my book set that you really start to see some of that development moving towards what you see later on in the early modern period. But the thing to remember really about later medieval witchcraft is, firstly, that they didn't really have a singly defined witch. You know, there was no kind of book that said, this is what a witch is, this is what they look like and what they do and how you can find one. And actually, some of those manuals were starting to be written right at the very end of the medieval period. They do start appearing. So the idea of magic was much more of a sort of a fluid idea, and it was very much believed to be both men and women. You know, we have this idea that later on it's all women who are accused, but actually it was very much both men and women. But there's definitely different strains of witchcraft that start to develop in the 15th century, and it's partly because of different gender roles of men and women, in that, you know, men were the ones who would mostly get educated, particularly to sort of university level. And because they were so educated and they had access to all of these old texts and from the ancient period, really, they're the ones who start to access these more educated ideas of witchcraft and things like necromancy, which is where it's believed that people can contact the spirits of the dead or even conjure them, and they could ask them for advice, they could ask them to tell their future for them. But as I said, that's very much believed to be a thing that men can do, because you need to be very educated to do that. It's not just something that, you know, the little old lady at the end of your street could access. And that is very important in the book as well, because if it's only believed that men could access those types of magic, if you're then going to try and accuse a woman of something, you have to tailor your accusations towards that. And one of the things that really starts to come out in the 15th century is this idea that women are connected to love magic. Because as we all know, women are very rational, they're very emotional, very easily led. And so, you know, as we all are. And so they're more likely to be tempted by the devil, and they're more likely to fall under his spell and start using witchcraft. And because they're so emotional, they really tend to turn to love magic, because they want to seduce someone into marrying them, or they might want to punish a past lover who scorned them, or simply in a more sort of everyday context, you know, they want to have children with their husbands. And so there's definitely this idea that it's women who turn more towards love magic and men turn towards this educated form of magic.
Yeah, and something that you get at in the book, talking about men in this educated form of magic, things like astrology, which we don't think of as a science now, they're very much thought of as a science at the time, and doctors, especially mathematicians too, really paying attention to things like astrology, and that wasn't a strange thing at the time.
Yeah, that was definitely something that I sort of needed to get my head straight with it, because as you say, today we have this sort of very separate spheres of religion and science and magic, but actually in the medieval period they are very blurred into one, and whilst they did have distinct ideas of it, you could do something as part of one of them, but it would look very similar to another aspect. So as you say, astrology, lots of people thought that it was a science, and it was taken very seriously, and you had universities with astrology departments, and yeah, as you say, doctors were expected to know astrology, because the way that you would treat a patient was expected to be different depending on the alignment of the stars and the moon, and you might be more or less successful in your treatment depending on that. And that's not to say that people sort of blindly accepted it, you know, people were still skeptical of it, like many are today. You know, people would sort of highlight, well, you can have twins and they live very different lives, or some religious men had issues with the idea that it's kind of interfering with this idea that it's God who's in control of everything. So there were still sort of criticisms of it, but yeah, very much considered a science. And even things like alchemy, which again today we consider that to be more of a magical thing, you know, you're trying to turn something into gold or into other substances, but again it was kind of considered a scientific field. And you even have like the Prince of England in the 15th century hires alchemists to try and make this work, because he needs money to pay his soldiers. And what better way than to make gold appear out of nowhere? So if we could all do that, I'm sure we would. So yeah, there is definitely this idea that you've got these scientific fields, but lots of them do start to meld into magic. And, you know, we sort of said that doctors would use astrological charts to treat their patient. Well, but witches would also use astrological charts, because certain spells would need to be done at a certain time of year or under a certain planet. And so if you've got these charts that you've made, it can be quite difficult to prove whether you're using it for science or for magic. And that's where you start to get some of these blurred lines coming through.
Yeah, and why it can be pretty easy to make an accusation against someone, even an important person. So your book deals with four very important women. So who are the royal witches in your book?
Yeah, so they're all across the period of the 15th century, and they're part of the English royal family. So it begins with Joan of Navarre, who was born about 1370, and she marries King Henry IV of England. We then have Eleanor Cobham, who actually marries Joan of Navarre's stepson, Humphrey, the Duke of Gloucester. And so she's born around 1400, so sort of slightly later on there. There's also Jacquette of Luxembourg, who marries Humphrey's brother, John, the Duke of Bedford, and she later goes on to marry Richard Woodville, who lots of people are very familiar with, and together they have Elizabeth Woodville, their daughter, who's the final woman in the book. And Elizabeth goes on to marry Edward IV and is quite important all during the Wars of the Roses.
I think that a lot of people, and you mentioned this in the book, are familiar with Jacquetta of Luxembourg and Elizabeth Woodville because of Philippa Gregory's book. So that's something that people are pretty familiar with. But the other two, I wasn't super familiar with. So to me, those are the more interesting stories in the book because they are less familiar. So
yeah, no, definitely. I have to say that sort of, you know, I did love writing and researching about all of them, but I definitely had more of a soft spot for Joan and Eleanor because, as you say, they're so little known. And, you know, it is amazing that you have got books like Philippa Gregory's that do sort of get those stories out there, because, you know, even when I was writing my book, you know, people are more familiar with Jacquetta because of the TV series and the book series. But even then, she still doesn't have her own book. She still doesn't have her own biography dedicated to her. So she's still quite understudied. And that's part of what surprised me about all of this, really, is that these women were so important at their times. And, you know, at various points in the 15th century, all of them were pretty much the most important woman in the whole country. And yet today, we haven't even heard their names, let alone these fascinating stories about them.
Mm-hmm. And I think that's, you bring them together mostly because they are connected in time and through family relationships, but also because they belong together in terms of how these accusations of witchcraft evolved. So the first one being Joan of Navarre. So can you tell us a little bit about Joan's life and her accusations of witchcraft?
Yeah. As I said, Joan of Navarre was born around 1370. She was Princess of Navarre, and, you know, her early life is somewhat of a mystery, really, because although she was a princess, you know, women at that time weren't really too significant. So, you know, you don't really get births recorded or lots of information about their private lives. So we sort of, as I said, don't know too much about her. But she probably spent a lot of her early years in France because her father had a lot of land there, particularly in Normandy. And eventually she goes on to marry the Duke of Brittany, and it's partly because of this connection with France. And, you know, the Hundred Years' War has started between England and France. The English want the French throne, and you have all of these independent territories in between that cover a lot of modern day France that are sort of stuck between the two countries. You know, lots of them have allegiances between both of them, and it's a bit difficult to choose which side to pick and not lose your own lands. So Joan's father picks the Duke of Brittany as a nice ally because of their proximity, and he's in a similar situation. So Joan moves out there. She's only about 15 or 16 years old, but by all accounts, she becomes quite a successful duchess. She has a lot of children with her husband, around 9 in total, and is generally seen as being this really ideal leader. And, you know, still we don't have too much information about her, but several of the stories that come out do show her acting in this perfect womanly way and interceding on behalf of the country when her husband's angry. And everyone seems to have really liked her, to the extent that she is made regent after her husband dies, because their son is only about 10 years old at the time. So there was obviously a lot of trust placed in her abilities, but she sort of has eyes for another man. She's met her third cousin a few years before, who was Henry Bolingbroke at the time, but he's only just recently claimed the throne of England for himself to become Henry IV. And they clearly were quite in love with each other, and they decided that they wanted to get married, even though it wasn't necessarily very politically expedient to do so, as the two territories of Brittany and England were not very friendly with each other and quite hated. But she moves over there anyway, and they have, you know, a very nice marriage together. But it's still very dangerous for Joan, because Henry is a new king, and there's all of these rebellions and revolts going on. And, you know, in the first 5 years of his reign, he has about 7 plots against him and his life. So it's definitely not a secure place to be. But he does lavish her in gifts and land and gold and money. She's given the largest dower of any English queen up to that point, and it makes her pretty much one of the most rich people in the whole land. She has an income of more than a tenth of the entire English crown's income, so definitely becomes a very powerful woman when she comes over to England.
She's really interesting for that, in that one of the things I noticed when I read this book as well is that it's for people who are interested in witchcraft, but I think also people who are interested in romantic stories, because a lot of these seem to be, you know, not great matches politically, but they seem to be love matches as well.
Yeah, that's definitely a theme. You know, all of the women there do marry for love, and some of them may have slight political advantages as well. But as you say, they were definitely women who knew their own mind, and it does kind of break that idea that people have of the medieval period of people only marrying for politics. They certainly broke the mold in that way.
Yeah, absolutely. So Joan has come over to England. She becomes a step-parent to Henry's own children, and things seem to be going pretty well. And then what happens?
Yeah, so as you say, sort of the country starts to calm down a bit. They come round to Henry's rule, and it all seems to be going quite well. But Henry has been very ill for quite a long time, and it's a bit of a mystery for us about what exactly was wrong with him. The records aren't too clear. There's some suggestions that it's a kind of leprosy, although we don't think it's in the sort of modern idea of the term. But it definitely seems to be some kind of skin issue that also affects his mobility. For the last few years of his life, he really struggles to walk, and so is really confined to London. So he is quite sickly, and so he does end up dying reasonably young, sort of in his 40s. And so Joan is left a widow, and a very wealthy widow. But as you say, she's taken on Henry's children as her own, and she has very close relationships with them. You know, we've got lots of surviving letters between them where they call her their most dear mother. And when Henry V, Henry's son, who's now king, when he becomes king, he continues to treat Joan very well. when he's off in France fighting the wars there for Agincourt and battles like that, he lets Joan use his own personal castles for her own use. So she's definitely seen to be held in very high esteem. And that's partly what makes what happens next seem quite a shock, really.
So what happens next?
So we sort of have this very strange situation where it's in the summer of 1419, so it's several years after her husband's died and she's still in England, and you have her personal confessor, so her personal priest, who will say her masses and things for her. There's an order for his goods to be seized, and there's no reason given for this order, and when you read the inventory of the items that have been seized, it's very clear that these are actually Joan's items. You know, these are full of jewels and gold and plate and dresses that are clearly belonging to Joan rather than to her friar Randolph. And it all seems very strange, but nothing more seems to come from it until the following month, where you get this really intriguing record in the Rolls of Parliament. And Randolph comes forwards and basically accuses Joan. And it's quite cryptic. He says that Joan has tried to kill the king in the most evil and terrible manner imaginable. So very emotive language there. Mm-hmm. And obviously quite a shocking accusation as well. So he's arrested. He does attempt to flee across the Channel, but he is captured and brought back to the Tower of London. And because of his accusations, Joan is also placed under house arrest.
So it's kind of a shock. And I think it would have been a shock for Joan as
well.
Yeah,
definitely.
Because there's no indication that she's ever had any bad feeling towards Henry at all. And all of a sudden she's being accused of trying to kill him.
So, yeah. Definitely, as you say, like, you can't really imagine what she must have been thinking to sort of have this shock accusation. And, you know, when you look at it critically, it doesn't even really make much sense, because her and Henry never had children of their own. So it's not like if she killed the king, she would have something to gain from it. You know, she would have her own children on the throne. And in fact, as I said, Henry had been treating her very well. So she kind of wants to keep him on the throne because he'll keep on bestowing her with all of these gifts. So it definitely seems like quite a strange accusation to be out there.
Yes, but you have a theory as to why she was accused. So what's your theory?
Yeah, so basically, once you start to look at the political situation going on at the time, and particularly it's quite important that it's in 1419 that this happens, because as I mentioned, Henry had restarted these old wars with France because he had sort of got the kingdom into a more secure position now that his dad had sort of stabilised it all. And he decides to try and get some more good PR, basically, for his own reign. He's going to try and get that French throne again. And it's quite good time to do so because the French king is suffering quite badly with mental health issues. There's quite a lot going on. He often believes that he's made of glass, and so he's not really ruling. So the French court is quite fractured between these different factions who are trying to take power for themselves, and that leaves them weak. So Henry started these wars again. You have the Battle of Agincourt, this sort of shocking victory for the English, and it just keeps on going Henry's way, and he's really winning over lands. He wins over some of the independent territories to his side to support his claim to the throne, and it's all going really well. But despite all this, you know, it's still been years of war, and during his father's reign, you know, there was not much money in the English crown's banks anyway, and he's now had years of war, so basically the crown is completely broke. But he's so close to success, he just needs a little bit more money so he can continue to pay his soldiers and continue to win that throne for himself. And then you look over at Joan, who, as I said, is absolutely wealthy beyond belief, and he clearly has someone at court comes up with this idea of taking her money for his own. And you can see this right near the start of the year. There's a document which doesn't survive anymore, but Agnes Strickland, a Victorian historian, wrote about it, where she said that Henry makes this order of saying, you know, see what we can take of Joan's. You know, we need to try and see if she'll give us some of her money, basically. And obviously she must have said no and not been too happy with this idea. And so they come up with this idea of, well, why don't we accuse her of witchcraft? Yes. And it's such an easy solution. You know, when you look at it, it's, you know, from an objective point of view, it's actually a really ingenious idea, because, you know, she's not really at court anymore. You know, she's not a big political player. As a woman, she doesn't have an official position where you can say, well, you know, she works in the chancery and she's been stealing money, or, you know, she's an advisor to the king and she's been giving really bad advice, because she doesn't hold any of those positions. So it's really hard to accuse her of anything. And witchcraft is such an easy solution because, you know, by its nature, you do it in secret. There's no one around to see it. So how can you prove that you didn't do it? You know, it's very difficult to. And because it can be linked to treason, like it was, it's just a really easy thing that you can fling out there. You don't even need any proof. You know, you don't need to try and find co-conspirators or anything, because it's something that she could have done by herself. And then you can take all of her lands for yourself.
And it is a very careful balancing act in this when you take it apart, because Henry wanted to accuse her of witchcraft so he could take her money and use it, but he didn't actually want any harm to come to her. So she's she doesn't actually go on trial, does she?
No. So as you say, you know, they do still have this close relationship, and although she was slightly closer to some of his siblings, you know, as I said, you can clearly see that he did care for her and want the best for her. And so he wants her money, but as you say, he doesn't necessarily want her money so bad that he wants her executed for treason. You know, he's not that terrible. So this kind of perfect solution is found where she's just never put on trial. And so because she's been accused, they can justify locking her up and taking all of her goods. But by not putting her on trial, you have a win-win situation, because if she is put on trial and found guilty, you know, she's now been found guilty of trying to kill the king. You know, that's a really serious accusation. Mm-hmm. And that could go really badly for her. But at the same time, if she's found innocent, then that means that Henry has to give back all of her lands and all of her money, and he has to compensate her for all of the loss and income she's had while she's been falsely accused. So either way, it's not going to go well for one of the parties. So by just sweeping it under the rug and not trying her at all, he gets all of her money, but he also protects her to an extent. And you can really see that these accusations were kind of just flung out there, but they're never really pursued, you know, because it's originating from the crown, which holds all of the power. They don't really need to convince anyone. You know, as I mentioned in the accusations by her friar, he doesn't even mention witchcraft. You know, it's this kind of vague allusion. And several of the chronicles at the time that record her imprisonment don't mention it either. They just say, oh, she tried to kill the king. And there's only one or two contemporary documents where we get this mention of she tried to do it by witchcraft, that it suddenly becomes clear. And so again, that shows that there is this level of protection around her where they're not really pushing it, saying, yes, she is a witch, and they're not spreading all this information. And one of the ways that this is most shown by is how well she is treated in imprisonment. You know, although they've taken her money, they still give her a very generous allowance. She has lots of servants. She's allowed to ride out. She's held in Leeds Castle, which has been home to previous queens of England, so it's certainly not a little dungeon where she's been locked away. And she receives all of these really important visitors. You know, her stepson Humphrey comes to visit her, Bishop Beaufort, who was Henry IV's half-brother, comes to visit her. She even has the Archbishop of Canterbury come for dinner. And, you know, if you're an accused witch who's tried to kill the king and the Archbishop of Canterbury is coming for dinner, you know, that kind of gives out a signal that, you know, maybe things aren't quite as it seems.
Yeah, and I think to me what might be the most obvious bit of evidence is at the end of his life, and Henry V dies young, like his father did, but even younger, when he's looking at death in the face, he restores all of Joan's properties and titles and stuff to her. Yeah. So that she is not a weight on his conscience.
Yes, yeah. I mean, that document just absolutely fascinated me. As you say, he becomes very ill, probably with dysentery from his campaigns, and it is very clear that he is going to die soon. And so he is having to stare death in the face. And you can really see, as you say, that his conscience is really weighing upon him. And, you know, he talks about restoring Joan, and he treads the line very carefully. You know, he doesn't even mention the accusations. He just says, you know, as you know, she's been imprisoned for certain causes. Yep. And yeah, he actually says the line, lest her be a charge on our conscience. So you can really see in this document from 600 years ago wow, he is feeling really guilty that he has treated his stepmother this way just for her money. And now that he's about to die, he's going, oh gosh, I need to fix this. And yeah, so he orders that she's fully restored. He says that she can have money for horses and to make some lovely gowns, and says that she is to be allowed to go wherever she wants in the country, and she can do whatever she wants, and everyone should treat her as if nothing's ever happened. And the strength of this is shown in that that does happen. You know, she is freed, she is returned to her position. She struggles somewhat getting some of her lands back, but that's mostly because he's given so much of it away. It's very difficult to get it back from people and give them some other lands in compensation. But she does, there's no other evidence that she ever suffers from these accusations against her. And she seems to have gotten on quite well with Henry's son, Henry VI, although he's a child for most of the rest of her life. When she does die, Henry VI makes sure that she is given a funeral with full honours, you know, deserving to a queen. She's buried in Canterbury Cathedral next to Henry IV. And so you can really see that she has been restored to this position, and she has managed to recover and overcome what's happened to her.
Yeah, it's a really amazing story, especially when you have this idea of the Middle Ages where if you're accused of witchcraft, that's it for you, you're burned, you're dead.
Yes.
And so it's kind of an amazing story. And I do want to get to Eleanor. So when Henry VI is in his minority, he's being taken care of by his uncles. One of these uncles is Humphrey of Gloucester, and Humphrey marries the next witch in the book, who is Eleanor Cobham. So what's Eleanor's story?
Yeah, so as you said, Humphrey is actually Joan's stepson, so he's the son of Henry IV, and he's the youngest of all the brothers, and so he's had quite a different upbringing, whereas Henry V was busy whilst he was a prince fighting for his father and leading armies in Wales. Humphrey is kind of the pampered youngest son, and he gets to go to Oxford University, and he gets to study and become quite a scholar and interested in the arts, so they're quite different characters there. But you have this woman, Eleanor Cobham. She's born around 1400, and she's the daughter of a knight. Some of her ancestors have been very important figures. So some of them have been Knights of the Garter. One of her ancestors was actually had a relationship with a previous Queen of England, Isabella of France. So she does have some very important ancestors, but by the time she's born, her family's kind of slipped down the rungs a little bit. So she would have had a very comfortable upbringing, but she certainly was nowhere close to the top of society. But she does find her way to court when she's in her early 20s, and she finds her way into Humphrey's household. And at the time, he's just married this woman called Jacqueline of Hainault. So she is Countess of Hainault, Holland and Zealand in her own right. But she's previously been married to this man, John of Brabant, and he's a bit of a character, really. He's not someone you want to be married to. He has all of these debts and basically loans out her kingdom to her uncle and says, you can rule it if you give me money to pay off my debts. And as you can understand, Jacqueline is furious at this because she thinks that she should be ruling it, let alone her husband, let alone her uncle. And so she basically flees to England, announces that she's going to get an annulment from her husband, and she does find refuge in the English court. Henry V is still alive at this point, and he thinks it's great to get some more allies on board, so he welcomes her in. And after Henry dies, Jacqueline gets this very precarious annulment. So it's at the time where you've got the papal schism. So you've got two different people at the same time claiming that they are the real pope. And she gets an annulment from one of them. But the important thing is the people in her kingdom and the people in England, they believe that the other pope is the correct pope. So in many people's eyes, this annulment isn't quite legal. But she claims that it is, and she takes this opportunity to marry Humphrey because he is now Prince of England, one of the heirs to the throne, and he thinks, right, this is a great opportunity for me to get some land and titles for myself, because he never expects to become king, so he wants to get power from another way. So Eleanor joins his household at this time, and there's so much activity going on, and the couple go off to the continent to try and reclaim Jacqueline's lands, but it's a huge disaster because at this time her ex-husband John has gotten the good books of the Duke of Burgundy, and he is a crucial English ally in helping with these wars in France. And the Duke of Burgundy decides that these lands look very tempting for himself and he wants them. So they really come at loggerheads over this land, but Humphrey is told by his brother and by the court of England that he has to back down because they can't risk upsetting the Duke of Burgundy. So he comes back home and abandons Jacqueline, and she gets captured and really struggles for the rest of her life to reclaim what's hers. And once Humphrey has returned to England, basically the popes sort of speak up and make a decision and go, okay, that original annulment that Jacqueline got, it was never legal. They got it from the wrong pope. And so that marriage was always in force. And so therefore, that means that Jacqueline and Humphrey's marriage never happened. It was illegal. But Humphrey thinks that this is a great idea because in the meantime, since he's come back in England, he's found himself a lovely mistress, Eleanor Cobham. And so he takes this opportunity to marry her. And again, as you were saying earlier, this is clearly a love marriage because he has nothing to gain from this. He doesn't get any lands, he doesn't get any titles, he doesn't get any money, and she's of quite a lower social status than him. And it's very clear that they truly love each other. You have a lovely quote from one of the future popes who says he holds outstanding love for Eleanor. So it really is this love match. And now Eleanor is a princess of England, and so she's really had this fairy tale rise.
Yes, and she gets right to the top of something that you mentioned a few times in the book, and that is the Wheel of Fortune. And we know that the Wheel of Fortune, it is a wheel, and it is going to turn. So Eleanor and Humphrey, they have a great marriage for quite a long time. Mm-hmm. But then Humphrey has way too many enemies at court, and that causes problems, right?
Yeah, so Humphrey is very much part of this old school of thought. You know, he was brought up in the height of his brother's power and the battles of France, and seeing his brother win the right to the French crown. And he was at Agincourt. It was one of his first ever battles, and he saw that huge victory. And so he continues throughout his life to really want to push this agenda of getting Henry VI the French crown. It's one of the things that Henry V got his brothers to promise on his deathbed, that they would continue this fight for his son. And so he really wants to do this. But people at court are starting to get quite tired of it. You know, they've been fighting for decades now. They've lost thousands of men, they've lost thousands of pounds, it's far too expensive, and no one's really that fussed anymore about having the French throne, and they just want to make peace and get on living their lives and, you know, ruling with power in England. And so he really starts to come at loggerheads with people, and one of the main people he has these battles with is his uncle, Bishop Beaufort, and the two men really despise each other, you know, all through their lives. I don't know whether someone offended someone at some point, but they clearly hated each other. And so they're constantly picking at each other, and whenever one of them does something wrong, the other one dives in to sort of blow it open and try and remove them from court. And yeah, as the sort of 1440s come around, Humphrey is definitely in a bit of a difficult position. You know, the country loves him. He is the golden boy that can do no wrong. But most of the people at court are against him now, and they want to move him out of the way so that they can have Henry VI's attention for themselves, and they can get him to do what they want him to do and get power for themselves. And this is really where Eleanor comes in, because at this point, Humphrey is the only one of his brothers left. Henry is unmarried, no children. He's still reasonably young, so it wouldn't be inconceivable that he might get ill and die. And in that case, you know, Humphrey is the heir to the throne. He could be the next king. And so you can't directly attack him. He's far too powerful, and it would just be suicide, really. But his wife is weaker because she is a woman. And as we saw with Joan, it's far easier to target a woman than a man at this time, because they just didn't hold the same power. They couldn't command armies in the same way. They didn't have the same allegiances as the men did. And again, you know, because Beaufort is involved, and he was clearly very much involved in the accusations against Joan, because he was one of Henry's closest advisors. He was the man who held the keys to the purse of the English throne, really. So it probably originated from him or some of his followers, this idea of, well, it worked really well with Joan, so why don't we try it again? Why don't we accuse Eleanor of witchcraft, trying to kill the king? And then if we can get rid of her, then by association, Henry won't trust her husband either.
Yes, and Henry VI was pretty easy to convince of a lot of things. So this worked a lot better against Eleanor than it did against Joan, didn't it?
Yes. I mean, Eleanor was certainly the saddest case in the book, really, because she really suffers as a result. You know, we said that Joan got off quite well because Henry did still love her and wanted her looked after. Well, this isn't the case with Eleanor. You know, this time it's her enemies that are coming for her, and they want to see her utterly destroyed. You know, they can't let her get off the hook because, you know, Eleanor and Humphrey are the favoured relatives of Henry VI. He loves them. He's always bestowing them with gifts and lands, and so they really have to destroy this trust that Henry has for them. So they rope in some members of the household, several priests who are at court and who've worked for Eleanor and Humphrey, and somehow they get them to accuse Eleanor of using witchcraft. And they say that initially she wanted her fortune cast, so using these astrological tables, and she wanted to know whether she would ever be in ever higher estate. So that basically means, would she ever rise to a higher position? And you think, well, she's already a princess of England. The only way up would be for her husband to become king, so she becomes queen. And the only way her husband's going to become king is if Henry VI dies. And they then insinuate that she then instructed them to use necromancy and to do all of these spells and conjurings to kill the king so that this can happen. And, you know, these are obviously very, very dangerous accusations. And Eleanor, at every turn, I think, makes the wisest decisions. You know, she has been criticized by some historians for how she handled it, but I think she did all that she could to stay alive. So as soon as she hears word that some people in her household are getting arrested, she knows that something is up, and she flees to sanctuary in Westminster Abbey. And this, I'm sure, saved her life, because it meant that she couldn't be tried for treason, because she's protected by sanctuary. They can't pull her out to try her for treason. And the other problem is they've never really had to try a woman of Eleanor's rank, and there's this idea that you have to be tried by your peers, and they're not really too sure how to do that anyway. So she's very safe there in sanctuary. They can't try her for treason. But unfortunately, because they've used these accusations of witchcraft, this comes under church law, because witchcraft is seen as heretical. It's seen as going against God, potentially being in league with the devil, and so they can try her for witchcraft. So again, they bring in her accomplices and they all make these accusations against her. They bring in sort of dolls and things and say that they've used this to try and kill the king. And again, Eleanor's very clever, and she melds these accusations to try and save her. So we mentioned earlier that women were seen as very irrational and using love magic. So she seizes upon this idea of love magic being a womanly craft. And she says, no, we weren't using those dolls to try and kill the king. I was using them to make my husband fall in love with me so that he would marry me. And then later on, I used them so that I could have children with him, because they never had any children. And so she's very much trying to move this away from an idea of evil magic and treason and over towards the sort of womanly side of love magic. So it does save her life, but sadly, you know, her enemies have come for her. It's very clear that Henry VI has been convinced that she did try to kill him. And so they have to make these accusations stick. And so she is found guilty of using witchcraft. And because she said that she's used this love magic to make her husband love her, they then divorce her from her husband. They say, well, if he was under a spell when he married you, he couldn't have consented to the marriage. So they divorce her, say it was never valid. And she is sent away to be imprisoned for life. And we're not too sure where this came from. You know, there's no singular order or trial or anything that would cause her to be imprisoned. But it's clearly come from Henry himself. And she's sent away from London. And unlike Joan, who was sort of cushily imprisoned in these nice royal castles, she is very much sent as far away as possible. They don't want her anywhere near Humphrey or the capital. So she's locked away on the Isle of Man. She's sent to castles in rural Wales and very much sent away. And sadly, she never sees her husband again. And she does stay in prison for the rest of her life. And she does die in prison.
It is, like you say, a really sad story for her.
Yeah.
I mean, she, again, this is important to note that she does not get burned as a witch.
No.
She's been tried, she's been found guilty of witchcraft, and still she survives. And so I just really want to emphasize this, because we do have this kind of wrong impression of witches in the Middle Ages. But she's in prison, she lives for a really long time, and this kind of breaks her husband, just like it was intended to, doesn't it?
Yes, yeah. So she manages to escape with her life, but unfortunately, all but one of her accomplices do get killed. One of them, intriguingly, is given a pardon, which I think is very strange considering how much they wanted to come after her. And again, it's kind of a bit of a signal that these accusations were political, because if they really had uncovered this conspiracy, you would wonder why they would pardon anyone. But one of her accomplices dies in the Tower of London. Another one is hanged, drawn and quartered, so he gets the treason death. So although he's admitted to witchcraft, he gets the treason death, because that's the one that's important. And she does have a female accomplice, and intriguingly she is burnt at the stake, but this is for a different reason to the sort of later witchcraft trials that you see, where the point of it is that this woman has been tried as a heretic. So 10 years before, she had been found guilty of using witchcraft, but at this time, generally, if you'd been found guilty of using witchcraft, unless it was something really nefarious, they would let you go with a little slap on the wrist and a warning. So she was let free with no consequences, but she had to swear that she would never use witchcraft again. So because she had used it again, she's seen as a heretic, she's seen as turning her back on God and moving towards the devil. And so that's why she's burnt instead, because it's the heretic's death. So again, it's not quite the same as being burnt for the crime of witchcraft. But yeah, things definitely go downhill for her husband Humphrey after she is found guilty. You can really see, as I said, that Henry really truly believes that Eleanor has tried to kill him. He pays for priests to say mass for his protection, to protect him from any spells that might be coming against him. And Humphrey really does not return to court for about a year. And even when he does come back, he really takes a back seat. He's not holding too much presence at court. He clearly doesn't really have any influence with the king anymore. And this is only amplified when the king finally does marry to Margaret of Anjou. And Margaret very much is also against Humphrey. She doesn't like him. She doesn't like the power that he still has and his popularity with the common people. And once she comes to court is really when you see Humphrey really lose esteem in Henry's eyes, and he gets banished from court. He's not allowed to come to court, which for the heir to the throne is, you know, a huge insult. You'd never have that happen. And he's clearly just being completely ostracized. And again, his enemies seize upon this and use this as this chance to finally get rid of him once and for all, because he does still have so much popularity with the common people, and he is still able to sway politics despite all of this. And so they hold a parliament, and the sole aim of this parliament is to get rid of Humphrey. And you know, so Humphrey comes along to Parliament. He has no idea what's going on. Some chroniclers claim that he went there and he just had the intention of pleading for Eleanor's behalf, saying, you know, please let her go, and we'll go and we'll retire and we'll do our own thing. You know, he just wants his wife back. Whether that's sort of the chroniclers who are on his side trying to really big up what happens next, or if it was the case, it's not too clear. But he comes to Parliament and he arrives, and his way is blocked by all of these guards, and he's told to go to a certain lodging. And when he's there, he is arrested along with nearly 50 members of his household. They're all arrested for treason. They all say that they've tried to kill Henry, and they've done this big plot to kill Henry and release Eleanor, and then Humphrey and Eleanor will be king and queen. So again, obviously really, really serious charges that, as Humphrey has seen, could go somewhere. And he just suffers some kind of illness, probably a stroke, and he is put into a coma for 3 days, and then he dies. And so obviously very tragic end for him. You can't imagine what it might have been like for Eleanor when she receives news of his death. But actually his death is a really big inconvenience for the court, because They're terrified that they're going to be accused of murdering Humphrey, and so his body's put on display to prove that they haven't done anything to kill him, that he died of natural causes. But it's a huge disaster. The country, as I said, they still love Humphrey despite everything that's happened with Eleanor. They still believe that he's the right person to rule, and there's, you know, sort of suggestions that maybe people don't believe these accusations against Eleanor. And so the fact that he's now suddenly died is a terrible PR disaster for them. And it really, you can see for years afterwards, there's constant complaints by the country of saying, look how horribly you treated Humphrey and how he died. And so it does kind of backfire on the crown. But despite all this, Eleanor continues to be locked up, as I said, and she lives for about 10 more years afterwards until she dies. And so she's never let free, even though Humphrey has died.
And this is, I want to get back to the fact that Humphrey was very popular and Eleanor was very popular, because we won't get to Jacquetta and Elizabeth because we won't have time, but that's another common thread that goes through the whole thing, is that even though these women are accused of witchcraft, it's a very serious crime, and they're all accused of witchcraft in treasonous ways, the people are still behind them, and the people don't necessarily believe these accusations. They come back on them.
Yeah, definitely. So all of the women in the book really navigated power very well. You know, it can be a difficult thing to be a woman in power because you have all of these expectations on you. And if you're seen as trying to interfere too much in politics, then people can really turn against you. But all of these women sort of seem to have known what the public wanted and behaved in a way that the public liked. You know, Elizabeth Woodville later on is very much the sort of ideal queen and seen as being very motherly, very religious, as was Joan. But yeah, definitely the public just really are drawn to these women, and you can see it time and again. You know, when Eleanor is in prison and Humphrey is still alive, you have this really curious incident that comes up in the chronicles where Henry VI is travelling through Greenwich, which is where Humphrey and Eleanor had their palace, so it's really their power base. And this woman who's unnamed, but she's clearly just a sort of ordinary woman, she comes up to Henry VI and she scolds him to his face and says, you've treated Eleanor horribly and you should get her home to her husband. That's where she should be. And of course, this is absolutely astonishing that someone is saying this to the king and telling him off. And you think, you know, that on its own makes you realise that people must have questioned whether these accusations were real, that they would be willing to defend a woman who has been convicted for using witchcraft. And that even if they might have believed that she did it, that they still didn't think that it was justified to treat her how she was being treated. And the same happens later on with Elizabeth and Jacquetta, where, you know, the city of London is really their power base. And, you know, when they're finding that times are difficult, the city of London are there to support them. You know, they send letters on their behalf to support their cause. Elizabeth spends a lot of time in sanctuary, like Eleanor did, and she spends sort of a couple of years in sanctuary across her lifetime. And this really appeals to the masses because she's seen as being an ordinary woman who's suffering with them rather than this sort of high and mighty queen. She's just one of them, and she's going through the same things that they are, and she's just a mother who's trying to protect her children. And this really appeals to them, and so you really see that the common classes really do support them, even when those at court don't. And in some cases that can be vital to their survival.
Yeah, I think that it's really interesting that you have pulled out all these incidents of the common people supporting these women. And obviously, people in the Middle Ages found them really interesting. And I think that modern people are going to find them really interesting.
Yeah, I hope so. You know, that was just part of really what inspired me to write it, was that, you know, I sort of found out about these cases and just thought, wow, you know, as you say, these are incredible women who were very powerful, very clever, did all of these amazing things and had all of these horrible things happen to them in their lives. You know, it's a very tumultuous century where you've got civil wars going on, you've got murders and rebellions and backstabbing at court. You know, it's a very dangerous environment to be in, and they do their best to survive. And, you know, generally, apart from Eleanor, they do come out quite well and they manage to navigate it. And they are such fascinating stories that you never really get to hear about.
Yeah, and I'm so glad that you brought them together and given us a little biography, short biography of these royal witches. So thank you so much for coming on and telling us about them.
Thank you for having me. Yeah, thank you.
It's a pleasure, and good luck with the book.
Thank you very much.
To find out more about Gemma's work and what she's up to, you can follow her on Twitter at Gemma H. Author. That's G-E-M-M-A-H Author. Royal Witches is currently available in the United Kingdom and will be out in North America in the spring. Before we go, here's Peter from medievalist.net to tell us what's on the website. What's up, Peter?
Hi, Danielle. Over the last year and a half, we've been having this column by Shari Boots. It's on Augustine in the Middle Ages, and she just wrapped it up with her latest post. So if you've been kind of following along about reading about St. Augustine and his influence on the medieval period, this was a really wonderful kind of series of articles. And I just want to thank Shari for contributing to medievalist.net. It was a really kind of a bit of an experiment to see if we can do something like that. And I think she did a really great job. So just want to say thank you to Shari. Meanwhile, you can also read about stuff like beer, how it came to England, and some more news about the Bayeux Tapestry, that it was actually meant for Bayeux Cathedral. So all that and more on medievalist.net.
Sounds great. Thanks, Peter.
Thanks.
For a couple of scarily good deals, head on over to our Patreon page, where you'll find subscriptions to Medieval Warfare magazine, membership in our book club with Boydell and Brewer, and a special $3 level where you can get access to medievalist.net ad-free. No tricks, just treats. That's patreon.com/medievalists. Gemma and I are both celebrating our books having just come out in the UK, and you can find mine, Life in Medieval Europe, Fact and Fiction, alongside Gemma's on Amazon UK or via Waterstones. If you're not in the UK, you can get my book directly from Pen and Sword Press at pen-and-sword.co.uk. Thank you so much to those who have already ordered it and who've shared pictures with me on social media. Want to share your own? You can find me at 5MIN Medievalist or 5 Minute Medievalist. And don't forget to follow medievalist.net on Facebook or Twitter at Medievalists for all the best and scariest medieval goodness. Our music is Beyond the Warriors by Guy Frog. Thank you for stopping by and listening for a spell. Have yourself a scarily good day.